Welcome to this Science Progress podcast. My name is Sean Poole, and today we're listening in on a conversation with Ed Paisley, our editorial vice president at the Center for American Progress, and the authors of the new book, Engines of Innovation, The Entrepreneurial University in the 21st Century. Holden Thorpe is chancellor of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, as well as the Keenan Professor of Chemistry there. Buck Goldstein is the university entrepreneur in residence at UNC Chapel Hill, prior to which he was involved in a number of information technology ventures. Let's listen in.
Listen, let me say thanks for the time.
Sure.
I'll tell you, I don't know how much you know about Science Progress and the Center for American Progress. Science Progress is a project of the Center for American Progress, a think tank here in Washington, and we've been very focused on the topic of your book. We've done a number of different reports, and we've gotten a lot of different commentary on regional centers of innovation and clusters and the like, working closely actually with Marianne Feldman of your university on a number of different things. So we're pretty up to speed on these things. And our focus at Science Progress is to connect the policymakers in Washington, both on the Hill and in the administration, with folks out there, including you, to connect academia with the policies that are being made and thought about in Washington. Well, first off, I mean, I think it's probably worthwhile to just ask a very quick question of why, you know, why this book now, and what brought the two of you together to write it. Obviously, you're in one of those clusters that is, you know, man-made rather than kind of generic, but also man-made over a very long time and very successful. So I just thought that would be the first place to start, kind of in your own backyard.
Right. Well, the university was very fortunate several years ago to receive a grant from the Kauffman Foundation to seed new concepts in entrepreneurship on the campus. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, hiring an entrepreneur in residence was one of the things that we promised to do with the grant, and Buck Goldstein, my co-author, was attracted to the university through that, and we worked together to start a minor in entrepreneurship, which is a novel idea we have here that allows students majoring in anything to take a four-course minor in entrepreneurship. And in putting that together, we realized that a lot of the things that we had been talking about hadn't really been put down in a book before, and that's why we worked with UNC Press to put this together.
Okay. Dr. Goldstein, what drew you to the program?
Well, let me just add from what Holden just said that now wasn't now when we started the book. So the book, 4 years ago, we thought we were going to be writing about entrepreneurship programs and the minor in entrepreneurship, and halfway through the book, the world changed, and we realized what we were really writing about was innovation,
right,
and how the country essentially could reignite innovation as a matter of policy, and suddenly what was about some minor changes in the university started to be more about an innovation policy for the nation. Mm-hmm. And so the now is different than the now when we started. And the other difference is Holden was a chemistry professor when we started, and he's chancellor of the university now.
Ah, okay. That makes sense. Before we go into some of the more nitty-gritty of the policy of innovation, both here in Washington and what you're recommending, I think it'd be worthwhile for our listeners or readers to, you know, for both of you to kind of, you know, very quickly give a rundown of your view of how this should roll out in a university-centered way, which I think is how you're thinking of it.
So it's always one size doesn't fit all.
Yep.
And our view in the book, I think, is more about some overall cultural issues. And one of the things that I think feel most strongly about, and in the op-ed piece that we wrote for you guys stressed, is that culture really is so much more important than structure, that mm-hmm. if you create a culture of innovation, that the specifics will be different everywhere, but you create an environment where the default, unless there's a good reason otherwise, may be yes instead of no, and where people are willing to try things and take chances and even fail. All kinds of things can happen in a culture like that. And conversely, if the culture is wrong, no matter what you do structurally, you're not going to have a place that that supports innovation and that embraces problems as opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that the other thing as background to the policy type ideas that we put forward is really the suitability of universities to address the innovation challenge that is facing America. If you follow the people who talk about innovation and creativity, Richard Florida, Dan Pink, Stephen Johnson, they're all talking about getting people together and cities as a kind of environment where innovation happens, because two people with disparate ideas that need to share them are more likely to come together in a city. But a university is also a similar environment, because you have a bunch of creative people with different ideas coming together in a way that maximizes the opportunity that might share them. And then you combine that with even though there's a lot of debate sometimes in the local media about universities and how they're run, there's still an extraordinary amount of public confidence in universities. And the financial resources, again, they're kind of being rebalanced now with state budgets and all of that, but there's a large amount of investment in universities in terms of the buildings and the endowment and the caliber of people that they're. So all of that creates a situation where you have many of the pieces that I think are needed to produce innovation in universities, and that's why we have advanced the idea that universities are so critical to this innovation future that John Cow and the other guys that I've listed have been talking about.
Sure.
Yeah.
Could you speak briefly also on how the universities can reach outside of their walls, and how important that is in terms of within the regional economy, within the communities, to kind of foster that place-based entrepreneurial development?
Well, I really don't think there's any choice, but one of the things we've learned is that the university's work is better when it's in collaboration with people outside the walls. Mm-hmm. So when we talk to Bob Langer and Joe DeSimone, two of the really most innovative scientists maybe in the world, they tell us that their scientific research is better not because people outside help them with the right answers necessarily, but more importantly because they help them with the right questions. Hmm. That being in touch with people outside the university helps them focus on what are the most relevant questions, where's the biggest bang for the buck, what problems should we go after. And so this unique ecosystem that exists in Boston and Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. and here in RTP is this dialogue between people inside and outside of academia when you get it right. And we certainly, there can be much more of it even than there is right now, helps much more with what's the right question, we think, than what's the right answer.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that we've learned is that it needs to be a bottom-up strategy. And, governors and secretaries of commerce and people like that can say they want to attract companies and all of that, and it can help. But what really helps is when you have interpersonal relationships that drive the externalization of the university. And so that's why, so when we attracted Buck here, that created a big change for us, because having an entrepreneur in residence was something we really hadn't explored. And now we have four entrepreneurs in residence, and we're working on getting resources together to expand that even more, because the power of an interpersonal relationship is much stronger than the power of a policy. And if a scientist or a scholar in another discipline is three doors down the hall from a person that he or she knows, and they get along with each other and they talk informally, and they find that person is from the private sector and they have more in common than they thought they were going to, and it turns out that they've got two ideas that need to be combined, then that has a lot more power to drive the application of research than any policy that a university administrator or a politician can come up with.
Yeah. Okay. Before we leave the region and into the policy thing, just one last question. One of the I would argue, one of the key missing ingredients in many of the university towns with lots of good ideas and even lots of good entrepreneurs is a lack of venture capital. And Kauffman, for one, among others, has pointed out that, you know, you really need to have a very active commercialization program within universities that will attract venture capitalists. And also, somehow, you've got to get some homegrown venture capital going, because it's not that easy to attract the folks from Boston, Austin, or Silicon Valley to drop into some of these other universities. First, do you agree with me? And secondly, what has North Carolina done in that regard?
Well, let's take the first part. First disclosure will be, my brother is a venture capitalist in the region.
Oh, okay.
who runs a fund called Hatteras Venture Partners.
Oh, actually, I've met him. We talked for a while because I was presenting a policy on Capitol Hill, and I wanted. Okay, well, that's great. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, Clay Thorpe, that's my brother.
Sure. Okay.
So I think that there is venture capital that will find good deals almost, not quite, but almost wherever they are. So I agree that you need venture capital in regions to help start things, but I think it's more important to produce an environment in the university where high-quality business plans can emerge. Because
right.
I think what happens is that in Silicon Valley, you have two things. One, you have a good supply of venture capital, but you also have a higher chance that the founder of a company is going to have a next-door neighbor who's a venture capitalist or a founder of a startup,
yep.
or she's going to have another colleague who is a venture capitalist or a founder of a startup. And as I was saying before, that kind of lowers the suspicion that academics might have about the whole thing.
Sure.
And that, in turn, produces a greater willingness to draw people from the outside to help produce business plans that can succeed.
Right.
And so I think even more important than getting venture capital in the region is to create a culture and an environment that produces not just great ideas, but great ideas that have been turned into high-quality business plans. And
right.
there's a step in between the ideation that happens in the university and the venture capital investment that I think is even harder to get done than attracting venture capital.
That makes sense.
So before we go to the second, let me just add that in some ways I think the bigger shortage is management talent.
Right.
That one of the great things that Silicon Valley has, and I think to a larger extent Boston has, and we have some of, but we could use more of, and I think many of these clusters lack, is the ability to is people who have done it before, mm-hmm. and who can take ideas and actually translate them. Once they're in place, frankly, the money follows. I mean, if it's an experienced operator and he's already done three deals and he's picked a fourth one and he's going to do it, there's not going to be a shortage of venture capital.
No, and I think that the venture capital funds, a lot of them have gotten too big.
Yep.
And so they can only make a certain number of investments, and they want to put too much money into a deal too soon. And there aren't enough deals around that can attract that. And so what's really missing are the venture capital funds that are willing to put hundreds of thousands of dollars or even less into a first deal as to get them to the point where they can start doing rounds that are big enough to attract the marquee firm. So we've got a mismatch there, and I think that it comes from the way venture capitalists do their fees and the way they raise their funds,
yep.
and the number of board seats that they're willing to take on. I mean, there's a missing piece of small capital and sweat equity that the venture capital industry as currently configured in the United States is not providing, and you can cite lots of experts who have done various forms of regression and things on this point.
Yeah, we've written a number of reports on that, angling mostly toward trying to figure out a way in which policymakers can somehow fix or correct or fill that gap. And it's not very easy, obviously. Why don't we switch to the policy side then? Because I think that's important here in Washington. As a bit of background, your book comes out at a very good time. The administration and Capitol Hill, both, there's a lot of discussion about how to come up with a better way to have the government help develop bottom-up innovation and economic competitiveness. It's kind of caught fire up here recently. So it makes it an exciting time of actually trying to put some policies into place. And there have been a variety of different ways where that's been tried. The administration experimented with the Energy Regional Innovation Cluster competitive grant process. And as you've noted, there are a whole slew of other competitive grants coming out to try and focus on big ideas to kind of move these policies forward. So I'd like to ask you where you see the problems of the federal government delivering the resources, the limited resources, but the resources that universities need so they can develop this regional bottom-up innovation.
Well, let's just go through some of the proposals that we have in our book,
sure,
which I think
that's
you
perfect.
Can put in. So the education's one. We feel like the minor in entrepreneurship where people can still major in a liberal arts discipline is really important.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to solve this by having more business majors, and you can get all kinds of people to come on here and tell you we need more scientists or we don't need more scientists. You know, we're going to get the number of scientists we have. What we need are students coming out who understand what risk is and what it's like to own your own business and control your own destiny. So on the education side, we feel like the model that we've set up is really important. To, again, leverage the liberal arts culture that American higher education has developed, which is really unique in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. The second thing is, the entrepreneurs in residence concept, getting the folks from the private sector to engage with universities in a way that is unobtrusive and enjoyable for both parties. We have seen that just bear so much fruit, and we think that is so important. Now, one of the things we talk about in the book is that we think people need to be careful when it comes to overdoing it with regard to placing companies in a particular location.
Right.
I mean, what America needs is more high-growth businesses that are successful.
Mm-hmm.
America doesn't need, although I'm sure the governor of Nebraska thinks we need more companies in Lincoln, Nebraska, or we need more companies in RTP, or we need more companies in Madison, Wisconsin. But really what the country needs is more companies that are successful.
Yep.
And so if a company is founded by a founder who's an RTP, but it turns out that that company is a social networking company, then it's going to be hard to come up with a reason why putting it in Silicon Valley doesn't make more sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of want people to be aware of the fact that, you know, just blindly saying we've got to keep this company near in this state or in this region is a dangerous proposition.
Okay.
You know, the other one or two other concepts, this notion about multidisciplinary teams and approaches.
Mm.
One, universities are the only place that can happen. I mean, there's no other institution in our culture where a doctor, a physicist, a chemist, and an ethicist can all get together and go after a problem.
Right.
And so, you know, it's our competitive advantage, but it's also the complex problems that are worth going after or worth research universities going after are the kinds of ones that require that multidisciplinary, getting out of the silo approach. And it's tough.
Now, one of the issues, I mean, and I'll be frank about it, it is a political issue. Are there ways that you think that naturally you can encourage companies to stay? I mean, through the SBIR and STTR process, through these regional innovation cluster competitiveness grants and such, that there's more of a policy that links the political imperatives with the national economic imperatives?
Yeah, I think there are. And I, again, we make the point that we don't, you know, that an unsuccessful company is not good for our argument. So we don't like it when the regional concerns create an unsuccessful company.
Absolutely.
All right? But I think that the SBIR program has been a huge help. And I think that, again, the thing that universities have going for them is that if you can create a company with a university founder matched with the right management talent and, you know, in a synergistic way where the two trust each other and they're working together, then there is a powerful incentive to keep that company near the university because you want to have the founder as engaged as possible.
Yep.
So if the interpersonal part and the cultural part of having the university founder stay in the university, and if she is paired with a CEO entrepreneur type who is willing to keep the company there, then that is a recipe for creating an advantage to keeping the company in a particular region where the university founder is on the faculty. And again, it comes, I mean, this one of the things about what we're saying is that the culture and the, I mean, you would think I'm a sociologist, not a chemist, because, you know, we think that the interpersonal relationships and the culture and, you know, where you eat lunch and all of that stuff is more powerful than anything that's quantitative or anything that's policy driven.
Right.
And so if you can make the soft stuff work in a particular place, then you can give that place the ability to keep companies there and for that to be a competitive advantage for the company.
Mm-hmm. So in Holden's example of keeping the professor here, the odds are three phone calls are going to have a bigger impact. I don't know what three phone calls, but three key phone calls would have a bigger impact on that than any sorts of structures or centers or anything else that might be set up, because the three phone calls were to, you know, a VC, somebody who'd done this before somewhere else, and one other call, and suddenly that mini ecosystem is created that creates an environment where her innovation can become a reality.
That's interesting. Do you think there's also a convening role for the federal government in terms of one person to go to that could work through the various bureaucracies and get the various things that might be needed in terms of, and this gets more towards economic development, but it's still important, you know, in international trade familiarity, regulatory familiarity, things of that nature? Is that something that would be welcomed and useful to the entrepreneurial push or even for small and medium-sized established companies that are working with the university on something?
Well, since I run a bureaucracy, I'm used to people being frustrated with our bureaucracy here, and I think people feel the same way sometimes about the federal government.
They do.
There are always people in any institution who know the right people to talk to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in a university, that kind of becomes part of the culture of the place.
Mm-hmm.
The people have been around a long time and know the first names of the people who answer the phones and that kind of stuff. And I guess that is a little impenetrable for the federal government, although I assume that people who do a lot of business with the FDA or the Small Business Administration or some of the entities we're talking about, the ones who succeed at it probably have figured that out. So the more transparent we could make that, probably the better.
Mm-hmm. You know, these competitions really work. The race to the top is a great example.
Sure.
And universities respond to money, especially research universities. I mean, it's what keeps the federal money keeps the lights on.
Right.
So to the extent that there are competitions that require working with entrepreneurs and residents or small businesses or other things like that, the apparatus in these big universities knows how to do that. They'll recruit the small businesses. They'll make the other things happen.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge, I think, is to create some leverage where, frankly, not a whole lot of money can create a lot of change, much like Race to the Top did.
Right.
And so you sort of map out what you would like that ecosystem to look like. You create a competition. You throw some money at research universities, and all of them will apply. All of them have apparatus to go after the money, and the impact will be that maybe only 5 or 10 get the grants, but all of them will have changed. As I think about it, we met for the Holden and I met for the first time when you were applying for a Gates grant.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, really?
And that was and that was a huge deal for all kinds of people. That what was that, the Millennium Challenge?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
We came in second. We didn't get it. But a lot of good came out of it.
Yeah.
And those kinds of processes. So the process of applying for a grant is something that universities have deeply baked into our culture. and so if you can implement policy in a way that leverages the ability of universities to put together competitive grant proposals, then you have leveraged a capability that is that obtains in America unlike anywhere in the world.
Right.
I mean, there's no doubt that if you a not huge, but a enough money to get people's attention is out there in a competition, and it requires the kinds of changes that we've outlined in order to apply, you get more leverage, and you'll have there's no better way to get universities in change than that, than holding out money and saying you have to do this in order to get the money.
Right. Now, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you've been up to Washington recently to talk with some folks about your ideas, but I'll tell you, a lot of what you're talking about is swirling in policymaking circles now, the challenge grants, all these various things. I found your book interesting in the sense that I thought you did a really good job of explaining and selling the idea of that this is something that is a almost uniquely American way to go about pushing bottom-up innovation. You know, it's not a top-down industrial policy by any means. Could you just speak briefly on how you think your ideas could be, I hate to say the word sold, but marketed or pushed or used as persuasion to get Capitol Hill to shift on the way it thinks about economic development and innovation and competitiveness?
Well, as you may know, I'm on Secretary Locke's National Advisory Council for Innovation and Entrepreneurship, and we've had two meetings, and we've started talking about some of these things.
Right.
And so I have spent time in Washington talking to folks, and we've also, Buck spent a lot of time with the White House, some White House staff, talking to them about some of the things they're working on. And one thing that we've pushed that seems to be getting traction, which doesn't require a lot of money, is the various things that celebrate entrepreneurship. So on the advisory council, we have a celebration subcommittee, to reward and recognize successful entrepreneurs. And that's something that the federal government has to give that doesn't require a lot of, doesn't require floor time. For people to go to the Rose Garden and be recognized as a great entrepreneur, or to the floor of, that would require a little floor time, I guess, to the floor of the House of Senate to be recognized. I think the federal government probably doesn't realize what a huge impact just that could have.
That's a really good idea.
So I think the celebration stuff is starting to get some traction. I think that you know this better than I do, but the legislative environment is such that in order to get some of these things into policy, it's not just a matter of getting people to believe it, but it's also figuring out how you would bring it to the floor in a way that would be practical,
right,
given the various things that are out there that people are wanting to get done, having to do with the budget and the handful of legislative ideas that are at the top. So the key is, you know, how do you get this to be not just something that people say is important, which is where it is now. People recognize this is important, but so important that it becomes one of the one, two, or three top legislative priorities of the Congress. The recession that is happening has largely been an American recession. I mean, I guess Western Europe had one, but the recovery is going pretty well the rest of the world.
Yep.
And America's lagging behind, and the reason is, we think, is because of the things that we talk about in the book. So there's a reasonable case to be made that this is the kind of thing that we've got to get going. People want to work for themselves. They're going to be working for themselves. Big corporations aren't going to hire and grow in the same way.
Yep.
And, there's no other. And the American higher education system and our education system in general, is uniquely set up to produce entrepreneurs. That's the thing that we have done better than the rest of the world for our entire history.
Yep.
One last question. As you think about the Hill, you know, our congressman, you probably know David Price, our congressman.
I do.
But, I mean, here's a guy who's a PhD and who fully understands the impact of the university. And if ever there's a spokesperson who's in Congress who can help lead the charge, admittedly no longer in the majority, but nevertheless extraordinarily articulate and thoughtful and understands all the things that we've just talked about, it's David Price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing we've discovered is the last question. I'll preface it briefly. One of the things that we discovered in terms of working with Capitol Hill to kind of get them to embrace this idea is that there's a real concern that when you talk about innovation and clusters and things like that, it's all city-based, it's all elitist, it's all university. It's not rural, it's not mainstream America. It seems to be for somebody else when you look at the broad mix of representation on Capitol Hill. And I think one of the great challenges is to show how the policies that, or the ideas and policies and cultural changes you recommend in your book connect to rural America, connect to ex-urban America in many different ways, because there's, frankly, that's where a lot of the votes are. And that really is one of the main issues, I think, that's an impediment to Capitol Hill to changing the way we focus on our economic competitiveness. I would like to ask you, both of you, the one question that I didn't ask that I should have, that you would like to answer now, because I, as you said, it's a sprawling topic, and I know I missed something.
That's a great question. I've been so focused on trying to answer the questions that you did. So there's one little piece that we feel really strongly about, and that is that if you're deciding on what in our culture and what our society to invest in, universities are a pretty good bet because, frankly, they're here to stay. And the little factoid that we discovered when we were writing the book was that of the 80 institutions that existed in 1550 and still exist, the 85 institutions that existed in 1550 and still exist, including Parliament and the Catholic Church, 70 of the 85 are universities.
Wow. That's interesting.
So, yeah. So the fact of the matter is, if you're looking for a long-term investment, it may take a little while, and it may be frustrating and feel like it's a little slow.
Right.
But if you're sort of guessing what's going to be here around not only in my lifetime but my kids' or grandchildren's lifetime, the universities are a pretty good bet. They have longevity and they have legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two things that are in short supply in our culture right now. So I would suggest that they're worth investing in because they're going to be around and because they're still viewed by the general populace is at least more legitimate than many of the other institutions that are under siege right now.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and I think one other thing, we touched on this, but the scale of problems and the suitability of our policy and financial systems to help solve them is something that we are still struggling with. So if you want to start a social networking site, to go back to that, you only need enough money to buy a server, and you can grow it to enough users that you could get your friend to put in a little more money, and then you could get money from kind of the mainstream venture capital firms, and you could grow it using just money from regular venture capital firms to a point where it's big enough to go public and you got, 100 million users or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So the financial system is very well set up for that. And I would argue that the rise of the Internet has been not just because of the new idea, but because our financial system was so perfectly suited to provide the right amounts of money to make that happen.
Right. Yeah.
Now, if you look at energy, that is really, really tough. I mean, if I were to tell you right now that I had invented some paint that I could paint on every parking lot and rooftop in America, and we could plug them all in and run the country with solar power, I'm not sure we would know how to finance that.
Yep.
It's the money required to do that is larger than venture capital could provide. We're talking about billions and billions of dollars. And I'm not sure how the federal government would come to the conclusion that that was something that they wanted to do. And so in energy, which everybody agrees is an important problem, there seems to be a kind of mismatch between the capabilities of our financial system and the problems that we need to solve. And then, you know, in food and some other things, we have some similar issues. So I think some thinking about the financial system and how it has, A, enabled the innovations that have succeeded, and B, hindered innovations that could be out there if we had a more deliberate way of doing this. I think that's something that, you know, is really important as we think about the innovation economy.
Yes. Okie doke. This is great. Thank you very much.
Sure. Okay. Thanks,
Thank
Ed.
You. Great. Thanks, Ed.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Take care.
You've been listening to our Science Progress podcast with Ed Paisley, the Vice President of the Editorial Department here at the Center for American Progress, Holden Thorpe, the Chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill, and Buck Goldstein, his co-author on the book Engines of Innovation, The Entrepreneurial University in the 21st Century. Thanks for listening.